Hello and welcome to Studio Sessions, the big red and shiny podcast where we talk with artists about the ideas, inspiration, and processes that go into their work. I'm your host Matt Kuhlman, and my guest this episode is Caitlin Masley. Caitlin earned her BFA from West Virginia University, an MFA from the University of Arizona, and is currently working on a Master's in Design and Urban Ecologies at Parsons in New York City. Caitlin's work focuses on man-made environments and living spaces, beginning with sculptures that express both the organic and geometric qualities of cities. Her pieces have grown to become large-scale installations that are accompanied by mixed media and digital works focused on the same subject. Join me as Caitlin describes her perspective on the spaces we create for ourselves to live in, and how her interest in the subject is beginning to move beyond making artwork inspired by them. Hi, Caitlin. How you doing?
Hi, how are you?
Good to meet you here. We're at the Lou Magnus Gallery, where you got to show up right now, right?
Mm-hmm. It's called Abandonment of the Solid.
Okay. And so, do you want to give me a quick rundown of your background before we start getting into your work? Because I didn't really research any of where you went to school or where you're from or anything first.
Awesome, thanks. I have a BFA from West Virginia University. I started out studying graphic design. And then I went into painting and printmaking, and then I have an MFA in printmaking from the University of Arizona in Tucson. Mm-hmm. And currently, right after graduating from the U of A, I came to New York, and currently I'm getting a Master's of Science in Design and Urban Ecology from Parsons.
It's a pretty diverse, widespread field there. But and so, what is your subject matter, I suppose, with your work? You just said that the four-year-old kid who was looking at your installation that's up right now recognized that it was an upside-down town up in the corner of this huge room or something. Is that, that's what it is, exactly, essentially?
It's definitely architectonic. Mm-hmm. The fact that he, like, recognized it as an upside-down town was awesome. But my background, my conceptual background is deals with buildings, facades, structures, the examining why we build, how we build as a human race, and what that says about us. Mm-hmm. It's more like architecture as a portrait of humanity in a way. Mm-hmm. And cultures. I was born in Columbia, Maryland, which is sort of this James Rouse utopia, and that has really influenced my work kind of forever.
Mm. Is that like a suburban area then, where there's like...
Yeah, it's this totally, you can call it a planned community, but it's between Baltimore and Washington, and this land was bought in secret by James Rouse.
Okay.
It was sort of in the 60s when there was like this, you know, the failure of the urban centers and the flight to the suburbs and then the suburban sprawl. Mm-hmm. And James Rouse wanted to deal with this idea of how do you plan, like, new town planning, this new urbanism in a way. So the way that the town is structured, there's a lot of architectural guidelines, the patterns of the streets and the houses, the mixed-use housing, and weird stuff like... He didn't just have urban planners working with him. He had, like, sociologists and psychologists. So in the 60s, they thought that schools with windows to the outside was distracting to students. So none of the schools had windows to the outside.
I think I went to a school like that, actually.
I think they call it a prison.
We had, like, long sliver windows that were about a foot wide and went, like, the entire length.
Yeah, those are called prison windows. Yeah.
It was some light in, but you couldn't really see outside. And there were also no walls between the classrooms, so it was just three classrooms in different corners of a large room with no interior walls between them.
Oh, totally. That was, that was the whole, like, psychology of, like, the open classroom. I literally failed first grade because of that, because of the noise level.
Yeah.
And so my parents shipped me off to private school for a couple of years so I could learn how to read.
So was the community like the kind of modular housing where it's a lot of repeated elements through it?
No, not really. It's more integrated than that. It doesn't look like what people think of suburbia when they say, oh, it's the suburbs. It's not like this box on top of a box. And I'm doing, oh, look, it's a rectangle. And it's really, they kept all the trees that they could and planted a mass amount of more. And it's sort of maze-like. It's really hard to actually get out and, like, get to a highway. They did a lot of, like, little hills and different kind of housing. And then, like, mixed-use housing, like row houses, low-income houses. And, like, they mixed it all together. So
they tried to make it more of an organically grown-looking environment and not so just quickly planned out and plopped down.
Totally. Like, well, the crazy thing is that when the cities of Baltimore and Washington, D.C. actually found out what was going on, they told James Charles he couldn't name any of those streets, any of the names within Baltimore or Washington, D.C., so he hired a poet. And so every single street is named something from a poem somewhere.
That's interesting.
I lived on Kilimanjaro Road. My parents still live there.
Not a lot of people can say that.
No, right? Although when I say I live in Columbia, they're like, Bogota? And it's like, no, Maryland.
I would think Missouri. There's Columbia, Missouri, close by where I'm from.
Oh, really?
It's where University of Missouri is.
There must be the planned communities out there, also.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a virus, this idea.
Yeah, growing up in the 90s, I definitely saw a lot of urban sprawl, but it was more like the cookie cutter houses like I was referring to. So but anyway, coming from that background, how are you addressing the idea of the structures that we build for our society and your installations that you do, because they look pretty like chaotic sometimes, like almost explosions in a way? Or is that what you want them to look like, I guess? Or
Oh, totally. I think the premise that I've been working off of for many years now is this of, in the 60s, there was the metabolists in Japan and Tokyo, and they sort of paralleled Artigrama in London, but they had this this real specific idea about an organic nature and prefabrication with materials of architecture, like it can expand and retract.
Mm-hmm.
That would suit the needs of the inhabitants and the landscape, almost as if it were nomadic or viral in that term. So a lot of the way that I work with these drawings, and I use these seminal buildings, social housing projects, or just buildings I get weirdly obsessed with. And in this case, here at Lou Magnus, it's really a lot of brutalist architecture. I'm pretty fascinated also with Spumonyx. That this sort of type of monument, like cement monument in and around the countries of in Russia. So mostly what I'm trying to show is a transition period of structure and architecture, of it taking itself apart and putting itself back together into something else.
Okay.
I mean, the best compliment I ever got, I was in this group show at the Iceland Museum, and one of the artists, she said that she had taken her 14-year-old son to see the Transformers movie, and she was like, that looks just like it. And I was like, that's awesome! I love it! That's exactly what I'm trying to make it do.
Shape-shifting.
Totally, yeah. Could you imagine if the building would just take itself apart and remake itself because that neighborhood needed something else? Because the population changed? I mean, that would be just awesome.
Very Archigram.
Archigram, yeah, totally. And, like, just very mobile And a lot of it also has to do with the landscape. So the drawings that are in this show have a lot to do with this abandonment of the solid. So abandonment of structures, like bare bones. A lot of the color palette that I'm using now are all these metallics, and they have to deal with like the value, like the dark golds and the value of land, and the sort of a lot of the copper and the Middle East. Which is like fundamentally the beginnings of building and structure. So, of like, you know, where we kind of started. So,
yeah, I saw some of these copper drawings that you're referring to online, and I was like, since I'm a printmaker, I've worked with a lot of copper plates, and like, I couldn't tell if it was actual copper, if it was copper on paper, because I was like, oh, it looks like a piece of copper that's all like scrubbed up, but other times I can't tell, but it's on paper, I can see now. But, with these forms that you're doing two-dimensionally, it's similar to the installation work that you're doing here with the architectural forms kind of organically emerging, but visually you're dealing with it in kind of a different way, I suppose. Do you think there's much of a distance between how you would treat the two-dimensional structures three-dimensionally, or they're just like fluid, one right to the other?
And that's interesting. I'm not really sure, to be honest. But in terms of printmaking, I mean, I also have a printmaking degree, so
mm-hmm.
I draw and I think I think like a printmaker.
Okay.
And my grandfather was a printmaker. He
mm-hmm.
did woodcuts. And actually, we ended up with this huge copper plate in our house. So when I was a child, I would go up and, you know, like run my hand over this beautiful, enormous copper plate.
Yeah.
but it's that idea of layering. And when I draw, I mean, and when I do the wall drawings, it's the same thing where I take an image and I move it. I draw it and I move it. And I draw it and I move it. And I layer. And I layer color.
Okay.
And then I also have been using a lot of whiteout. So there's also like a layer of like negative and subtraction.
Mm-hmm.
And with the sculptures integrated into the wall drawing, it kind of creates this sort of complete installation. And I've been trying to push more into like three-dimensional, and that's challenging in the drawings because I think of them as topographies, like aerial view topographies.
Okay.
So there's a lot of patterning.
Yeah, on the left there's kind of obscured, it looks like, looking down from a plane almost, like at the farmlands or something.
Yeah.
So you can
yeah.
really see that sense. As far as reference material for these, do you go out and examine a lot of on-site things, or are you dealing with it more just the idea of architecture and structure and drawing it from your own mind?
I don't think you can get away from drawing things from your own mind.
Mm.
I mean, the way that you recreate memories chemically,
mm.
it's always a new recreation.
Yeah.
But I try. I mean, I spent many years doing international residencies and going to places and seeing neighborhoods and walking. I have a thing for walking. Like, I really love just to walk and walk and walk and walk and walk
mm-hmm.
a city so I can sort of feel what it feels like in the texture and, like, the urban fabric in
mm.
a way. So I think a lot of what I draw, I try and have a personal relationship of where I draw, but then there's a lot of places I'm not able to travel. And so I have, like, architecture fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I find, like, the really beautiful big books, and I cut up the books.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, for a while, I have this friend who's a photojournalist, and he was going to the Middle East constantly, and I would dig through all his photos.
That's a lot of your source material there, I'm sure.
Yeah, like really, really awesome stuff. And I mean, I would love to be able to travel more in the future,
mm-hmm.
But I have such a archive. I keep like sort of a personal archive of buildings. I'm like, oh, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But even in the media, I like to sort of scalp from there and to see how it's, architecture is being presented to us in mass media. I mean, the two prints, the monotypes that are up on the mezzanine level, they're from a triad of buildings in Uzbekistan, which are built like the architecture of peace.
Mm-hmm.
And this was this big article in the New Yorker, and it's just like, okay, is that what the architecture piece looks like? Is that what we're creating and presenting to people? So
I didn't notice that when I walked in, but is it part of that series where you were taking those Middle East images and like making symmetrical kind of pattern designs out of them?
Yeah, they're kind of reconstructions. I mean, what happened was that was the period of time where I was in Berlin for quite a while, and then the war broke out, and I was like, oh, should I go home? Can I get home? And then this whole idea of like reconstruction was such a big word. Like,
mm-hmm.
we're going to reconstruct it. And it's like, well, you demolished everything. It's not reconstruction. It's construction.
Yeah.
So it was, it's part of that series. Like, how do you actually construct? What does reconstruction mean? And so that series of photographs is about, well, I took some of the bombed out buildings like the airport and
mm-hmm.
A couple of the palaces, and I reconstructed them into like fortresses.
Yeah. Because
that's what they end up looking like when you reconstruct
them. Some of them I remember did look like fortresses, and they look like pretty big, impressive buildings anyway, but when you kind of compound them and
stretch them out, it looks like this massive, like, monument almost.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, I can't remember all the buildings that you used in there, though. Do you remember? Because some of them just look like the neighborhood built, you know, and you, like, stretch it sideways, but then some were, like, so complex where it kind of built out like a snowflake almost. And do you know, like, much about what the actual sites were, or were you just kind of,
them? Actually, because they were from that photojournalist, like, archive. And I was like, I want that one, I want that. Well, one of them was the airport, which I think was politically important. And that also plays into a heavy part of my concept, is usually there is some sort of political or social significance in the for using that image in it for me. So there was the Saddam Palace, a couple of Saddam palaces, the fortress, the twin towers, these like that were sort of iconic. There was a few just like the neighborhood streets of Baghdad, and then there was a housing project, actually, like the first ever housing project. So I sort of recreated that into an illusion where there's only one entrance and one exit.
Okay.
And so it's like there's only one way to get ourselves into this, there's only one way to get ourselves out of this, and then it's sort of like a closed compound. So there's a lot of underlying levels.
That's getting back to some of your sculptures and installations, some of the other ones that I saw were similar to what I saw here, but it looks like they're made out of different materials than these ones are. They look like they're metal or something, or plastic. Was I seen that right? Or what do you usually work in, I guess?
I usually work in foam core.
Foam core.
Because
it's a good illusion, then.
Isn't it? And then I've been taking to spray painting them, actually, and so some of them look silver, like they look like stainless steel, or gold, like in this installation, there's a lot of gold, and so it just sort of looks like it blends into the, or it becomes a three-dimensional aspect, and when you walk around it, it sort of changes the dynamic of the space. I would love to make them out of steel. We did make a prototype recently of a small one, and I ripped a hole into my leg because the kisses are really sharp.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I did. It was I wasn't paying attention to where I was going, and I was like, oh, that's sharp, because when you make them out of foam core, they like you can cut a very accurate corner. And I hand cut them all. I don't trace them or laser cut them or anything. Because they're built in this metabolist way where I make a series of cut based on a facade of a building that I'm thinking about and then piece it together on the floor, and then we hang them upside down and then I start building it so it looks like this expansion traction. And they're site specific, like none are the same ever, and when the exhibition is over they usually disappear.
I take them apart.
And then even if they were put together again, they would never be the same because the slots don't fit the same. And I love that idea, that temporality, that this only exists in this moment of transition. If you didn't experience it, then it doesn't, you'll never experience it.
Do you incorporate any kind of performance aspect to that, like allow people to watch you as you construct these things? Or do you have much of a planned out thought process when you're doing it, or is it more spontaneous where you're just, this would look good here, and you stick it on?
I just walk around saying, that looks awesome!
Yeah.
I have a real affection for spray paint, and actually, here in the Lower East Side, around the corner, there's Turf City, and they rock. They have the best spray paint collection ever, and they're real, like, graffiti artists, and I love this idea of, like, doing graffiti about buildings, like, inside a building instead of on the outside of a building. But in terms of my process, it's really spontaneous in the way that graffiti can be. And often I I don't have a purpose, like a purposeful audience, but it took how many of us? Like 15, 20 interns to make this installation. It's the wall drawings take a really long time, only because the space was so big, and it's a layered process. So I find I have buildings, and we have projectors. We had like three of them, and they're projecting, and everybody's tracing.
Okay.
And then they move them, and we trace again, and then we turn them off, and then they get painted this matte black acrylic, so it pushes back into the space, and then comes the layers. And then there's a couple days where I just spray paint and I draw. So I'm literally drawing with the spray paint on the wall.
Okay.
And then there's like copper leafing pens and whiteout pens that have a little detailing at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And then somewhere in the middle of that, the sculptures get made, and usually there are like 15 interns around. But it's really just about like, I don't know, it's so internalized now as a process. And but I react to the space, and I don't consciously think about it because I want that different kind of dimension, that site specificness.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
this is the largest one that you've done, right? Wall drawing?
Yes. What is this, like 40 plus
like 40
feet? 50.
Yeah, that's 40
feet.
That's
tall.
Right. And the ceilings are like, what, 18 17, feet?
Yeah,
17,
yeah,
18.
Yeah, 18.
You get
right.
hurt if you fell off that scaffold.
I didn't
yeah.
really often get on the scaffolding. The interns are amazing. But that's the other problem, is that there's a lot of, like, I had to be down and looking at what was going on up there.
Mm-hmm.
And the weird thing is that having to instruct someone almost to make your work for you in a way, which is very odd and awkward.
Mm-hmm.
But the scaffolding was kind of scary.
So do you do much pre-sketching, or, like you said, is it mostly just an internal editing process as you go?
I never, ever sketch.
Never sketch.
It's really funny that you asked that, because I was on a panel for at the Drawing Center years ago about Yona Friedman's work, and he sketches out everything, plans, and he's got, like, massive sketchbooks, and I love people's sketchbooks. I'm like, oh, I'm going to do a sketchbook.
Mm-hmm.
But I end up sketching, and I end up actually making drawings. So, like, I make these smaller drawings,
mm-hmm.
and then they turn into, they are something, and they often work collectively. I often
yeah.
work in groups of drawings.
Mm-hmm. So you just kind of make a small drawing and just expand that idea.
Yeah. I don't usually throw them away.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just sort of work through it and make the next one, and if I don't like it, I'll just put it away.
Mm-hmm.
But I won't rip it up or throw it away, because I know it's part of maybe a larger idea.
Mm-hmm. And some of your earlier sculptures that I saw, it looked like most of them were kind of standalone pieces, not so much like large installations. Was I seeing that right?
Yeah, there's an earlier series based with the same sort of photographic work, where I was exploring paper, like large plotter prints, color plotter prints, and I would print out these buildings and cut them out and reconstruct them into other buildings, and then make little paper cities, sort of like the way that Dan Graham was making this, like, architecture for children. But I wanted it to be really interactive, and it's like, how do you make art that people will touch and play with, because you're trained, like, don't touch the art.
Yeah.
So I made these series of little buildings. I won the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, the LMCC Swing Space, and got a nice grant to make an installation of that. And so what I did was, I had the opening where I had like thousands of them in the room, all these buildings, different sizes, and people come in and move them around, and through the course of the exhibition people could come in and move them around, and at the closing everyone got to take some home, and they were like additioned inside.
Mm-hmm.
So there I would, every now and then I get photographs from people who have taken them, and then they move them around their house.
Yeah.
And they send me these photographs, and they're really awesome. I'm like, oh, that's so sweet.
Mm-hmm.
So,
you gotta show
those
photographs.
Yeah, and like people's like buildings inside houses. It's really, I mean, it's really awesome, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So
working with this subject matter and the style, is this something that you've pretty much always done, or was there a lead in that was a little different to this work?
I think it's almost come for conceptually full circle, if not visually.
I guess, like, what was the starting point, or what did you come out of that came into this?
Oh, that's interesting.
Looking way back here.
I don't know. I'm searching my memory. I have to say my thesis show for my MFA, I was dealing with the utopia of Colombia. And I did an installation with, like, AstroTurf and, like, 1,000 books on utopia and urbanism. And, I mean, maps and models. And, like, I had, like, wooden paneling everywhere and, like, crazy constructions in the museum. And I think that was the jumping off point to installation work, that I loved the experience. Like, I mean, I had a TV and a chair, and I would go in and hang out with my dog at that point, and people would come in and interact, and we would have a dialogue about new urbanism and utopia, which nobody actually says the word utopia anymore. Like, so that was a real attraction to me. Like, that's where I find art really powerful. So working in a variety of medias that I think a lot of artists do over the course of their careers, I sort of come full circle back into installation work.
Having an interest in that sort of thing, what kind of changes do you see coming in urban development or city development? Because I know that things are changing rapidly. Like, they can't keep doing the cookie cutter houses all over the place just because it's not environmentally efficient. That's becoming a tipping point problem. And just in your interest in that subject matter, interests of what's developing in that field?
Oh yeah, I mean, that's kind of why I went back to school to get this MS in design and urban ecology. So urban ecology is looking to study the future of cities and how we can build for the future of cities. I mean, in New York it's pretty intense because we just had this huge hurricane and it really destroyed way more than anybody could imagine. And so resetting how everyone's thinking about the urban fabric is fantastic, and it's really great to be here at the time to be a part of that, because it's a holistic future. You can't just say, oh, we're going to build and help the economy and build, because you just can't keep building. And you can't keep building buildings because they're the least eco-friendly thing on this planet, besides airplanes at this point. So it's like, how do you change? It's not just building differently, but it's how do you educate people to live differently, and how do you change people's mind in a social way to live differently. And a lot of what we deal with right now is, like, urban farming, which is awesome, and green, you know, really being as green as possible and getting the city to restructure internally, because city government change is a slow process.
Yeah.
So it's not just good design, but it's also changing the law and the policy about that. So I'm totally down with that.
Have you looked much into the Earthships out in New Mexico and stuff? I think the guy's name is Michael Smith.
Yeah.
He builds really elaborate houses out of garbage, basically, and they're nice.
Yeah, I think it's great. And I mean, my dad's family is from Albuquerque, so it's like, and that whole Southwest mentality is so different than, like, something.
I wouldn't work here anymore.
I don't know how that would.
I wouldn't want to be in the 55th floor of a garbage skyscraper.
Yeah, I don't know. We'd probably all have to lose our sense of smell.
I don't think it was dirty garbage. He would just use, like, he would pack tires full of dirt so hard that it becomes like an adobe brick, basically, and use that to make walls.
That's
so
awesome. And you can do that. I mean, a big part of thinking about the future of cities is thinking about the local climates. I mean, the hurricane here, tornadoes, the heat in the Southwest, you know, the materials that are available locally, and building with those, and being, you know, becoming truly sustainable and not just, like, it being the next it word or dead it word. But it was really funny when I was in graduate school in Tucson. I mean, they have the whole biosphere thing there, and you know, and they're still trying to do it. It's like, okay, that's awesome. You can keep trying to do it, but, like, can you try and do something different? Because most of the world doesn't work. You don't live like you live in a biosphere.
Yeah.
And so how do you live in India? How do you live in Antarctica? How do you live in all these drastically different climates and global warming, and think towards the future?
Yeah. Well, I'm about out of questions for you. Is there anything you wanted to touch back on or add before we go?
I don't think so. I think we covered everything. Thank you so much.
That was fun. Good talking with you. We'll see you around.
And that concludes this episode of Studio Sessions with our guest Caitlin Masley. You can find her work online at caitlinmasley.com. You can also learn more about me at my website, macwoman.com. If you'd like to support this program, you can send a donation through PayPal to studiosessionspodcast@gmail.com. Even if you only send $1, your donation helps guarantee I can continue providing interviews with interesting artists for your listening pleasure. And of course, don't forget to visit BigRedAndShiny.com for future episodes along with other high-quality arts and culture content. Thank you for listening, and see you next time on Studio Sessions.